Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, May 16th. I'm your host, Magnus Teeval, and joining me today is Stephen Fenn.
Yeah,
hello. Stephen.
Good morning.
And we're bringing you today's edition of Speak Up. We have some interesting stuff lined up for the show. We're going to get started in a few minutes with an interview done by host Vivian Frutal. And it's an interview with Dr. Angela about gender-based violence. A little later in the show, we're going to talk about traditional Chinese medicine and an interview with Les Moncrief. We have some good music, and we're going to talk about a bit little later on the show. Stephen's going to be joining the show on an ongoing basis. We're going to talk about some of the topics that we're going to be covering going forward under this new management now that Vivian has returned to Germany.
Thank you.
So let's get started here. This is an interview conducted about 2 months ago by Vivian, who's the former host of this program, on the topic of gender-based violence with Dr. Angela.
Hi, first of all, and who are you and why are we here today?
Thank you, and hi. My name's Angie Brooks-Wilson. I'm the new Dean of Science here at SFU, and I've been in the role just over a month. This is following, our discussion here is following the ceremony to honor the women killed at the École Polytechnique on December 6, 1989, and to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion in STEM.
And you were talking about gender-based violence is connected with racism as well. Why is it connected and how is it connected?
I should say that I'm not actually an expert in this particular field, which I think would be more sociology. So my answers are more the, you know, based on the life experience of one person rather than being correct in a social science sense. But I think that I tend to view discrimination against one group as connected to discrimination against another group, perhaps relating to people who feel the need to discriminate because they want to feel superior to someone.
And you talked about how women in the field of scientists are treated right now. And do you see a development right now in Canada in the field of science?
I do see changes. I have seen changes in how people behave towards women in scientific workplace over the course of my own career. It used to be more that certain ways of joking around that could make women feel not included were commonplace in the workplace. And now I don't hear very much of that at all anymore. So I do think that things are changing in terms of how people behave in the workplace. And I also think that things are changing in terms of processes that we use to try to ensure equity, diversity, and inclusion in places like SFU. So, for example, when a hiring is done for a professor position, we have formal ways of looking at the applicant pool and making sure that, for example, the short list should reflect the diversity of the long list and should not be moving towards just a subset of that list.
And where do you still see room for improvement, or what can people still do better right now in Canada or all around the world? Because there's still problems, right, or things that can be better? Or what do you think about that?
It's a hard question to answer. There definitely are things that people need to do. I think so much of the issue lies within each person. How do you re-educate a person who maybe was brought up to think that certain groups are not their equal to understand that they really are? I don't know how to overcome that problem, but I think that in workplaces like at SFU, where they're very organized, we have systems and a very clear intent to move toward equity, diversity, and inclusion, I think that people in workplaces like ours can become familiar with those processes and work in an environment that really is aspiring to EDI and become, I hope, more enlightened by doing that.
And do you think women in science or in male-dominated work field are still underestimated, or are they more appreciated now? Because the work and their work, is this more appreciated than when you began to study, for example?
I think appreciated might be too strong a word. I think that being accepted and treated as equals, I think we are slowly moving in the right direction. But we're not there yet. I think we'll be there when the numbers are equal in the various areas.
You talked about you were in SFU for 1 month, right?
I've been in the role of dean for just over a month, and I've been at SFU since 2008.
Wow.
In various ways.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And you talked about plans for the future. You're comfortable to share this with us as well? Like you talked about you don't have an exact plan, but you talked about plans in general or ideas for the future. You want to share this with us?
I can share a little bit of it. So I'm very big on making plans with the faculty. I have a lot of ideas for all aspects of how we run the faculty, but I want to also welcome ideas from the grassroots, from all of our professors, our grad students, and so on. And we will have a formal process of strategic planning to do that. And I'll knit together my ideas with the ideas of our professors and students to arrive at a good plan and specific goals. For the goal of increasing equity, diversity, and inclusion in the Faculty of Science, we have one action that is upcoming. The previous dean, Dr. Paul Kench, started a position called the Associate Dean for EDI. And that position was occupied by Dr. Mary Catherine Kropinski for a couple of years. And Mary Catherine moved up to a position of special advisor to the Vice President, People, Equity, and Inclusion. And so the role has been vacant for a few months. So I have discussed with the department chairs that we will be reactivating that role, and very soon we will be calling for faculty members within our faculty to apply for that associate dean position. Once that person is selected, they will be the lead person for initiatives to increase EDI in the Faculty of Science. And so they will lead an EDI committee. They will be able to help organize ideas to improve EDI. They will probably look at all our processes to ensure that they are robust in terms of considering all groups equally. And so that will actually be a very important position. And so I will work with and provide ideas to that person.
Nice. That sounds very good. A good plan
Thank
for
you.
The future. You also shared your own story at your speech here at SFU. And there also, do you have any tips for girls who are struggling with gender-based violence in the field of science? Do you have any tips for those who are struggling with it still? So because you shared your own story and you talked about it, you were had not the courage to speak up against the men, but because the men had no power over you, it didn't change anything for you. But what do you have a tip for a girl who is still struggling with a man that has power over her?
Oh, that's a really difficult question, because if you're referring to women in other countries where they're working under a regime where women are not considered equal, my life experience doesn't give me much to advise them. So I think that's a very tough issue, and I just wish them the best in their fight for equality. For female STEM students here in Canada, I think that my advice would just be stick to your goals and try not to be deterred by bad attitudes by some other people. Most other people are good and supportive, and it's a few bad apples out there that would try to deter female students. But I would just say stick to your goals and perhaps seek mentorship from a female faculty member, or band together with other female students and share your experiences so that you have a support group with each other. And yeah, just stick to your goals.
And do you have any last words for us, or any statement or a tip or something else?
No, I would just say thank you for using your radio station to raise awareness of this really important issue. As we heard in the event today, one of the young women who spoke said that she hadn't realized that there was discrimination against women in STEM until she saw it herself. And so just knowing that it's there and being ready and being aware of the issue, it's good of you to raise awareness. Thank you
so much. And you can rehear the interview on cjsf.ca. And thank you so much for this interview.
That was an interview with Dr. Angie Brooks-Wilson, who is, well, now not so new, but at the time that interview was conducted in the late fall at the ceremonies commemorating the December 6th massacre in Montreal. Dr. Angie Brooks-Wilson is the Dean of Science here at SFU, new in the role as of last fall, and speaking with our reporter, Vivian Frudel. With me today is Stephen Fan. I'm Magnus Thiewald, and we are your hosts for today. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning, Good morning.
And let's do a quick check-in on the weather here for the Vancouver area. It's going to be a pretty nice week. Looking at the forecast today, pretty much sun and clear skies pretty much through to the rest of the week. We have a bit of mix of sun and cloud today, with highs up to 23 degrees, although in other reports I've heard perhaps as high as 28. Certainly, you will get higher temperatures more inland, and that's going to continue throughout the week as far as the seven-day forecast goes. So sun is what we're expecting.
It's great. Going to be a great, glorious Vancouver summer.
You bet. All right. Well, you know, Stephen is going to be joining the program and doing some, bringing us some interviews and other content. What are the things you're interested in particularly covering, Steve?
I'm very interested in issues relating to justice and equity, especially in the housing field. As we know, housing is a very challenging issue here in Lower Mainland, but especially for students. Mm-hmm. And you know, in connection with that, I'll also be covering local politics in sort of the Tri-Cities area, Port Moody, Coquitlam, Burnaby as well, because, you know, that's where we live and that's part of our community. Yep. And so I'll be doing these things, but also kind of exploring kind of grander, kind of more regional issues, you know, like what's happening across the province, what's happening across the country, how does what's happening in the world relate to our community here up on the mountain. And so I'll be exploring a range of topical issues. I hope to bring to you fresh and interesting interviews that are hopefully informative. And I'll try my best.
Great. Yeah, housing is definitely a topic of interest to me as well. I mean, we've had a housing crisis here in Vancouver at many levels for a long time. And, you know, for a long time, you know, the debate really just revolved around, you know, increasing house prices and the difficulty for people getting into the market.
Yeah.
But over the last few years, we've really seen an acceleration in
Rental
prices as well, which becomes a double whammy because first off, it creates real problems for people getting adequate housing.
Correct.
You know, whether they have enough, you know, a big enough apartment for their family so everyone has a proper bedroom and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it also creates a problem that the more income that goes into people's rent is less they can save for their own goals of perhaps owning one day, as well as competing with the other expenses they have. So it really is getting to be a real problem. And I know for myself, it just seems like government is really failing to address the problem. There's a lot of talk, but then not much happens. And if anything, the problem seems to get worse.
Yeah, it's a really multifaceted issue. And I think you're absolutely right that in a sense, the rental crisis compounds a long-standing housing crisis, in the sense that it used to be just really an ownership crisis, that it was hard to get into the market for ownership, or if you could afford anything as a small condo. But now it's, you know, you're trying to just make your ends meet as a student, and you can't even get, you know, a one-bedroom, you know, share or whatever. You know, you see all these people who are desperately trying to get dens in apartments. Yeah. And I think that's putting the squeeze on incomes. You know, I know people who are making good incomes in sort of good jobs, near six-figure incomes, who are spending 40% of their income after tax on rent. That's just not sustainable. And, yeah.
And, you know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, the more people put their income into housing, you know, that's less income they have for the other things that help drive our economy. I mean, we here in North America and the West in general have a very consumer-driven economy.
Absolutely.
So if you're putting all your money into your housing, you don't have anything left over for, or not much left over for, the sort of consumer purchases that are at the core of our our economy. What does that do to the rest of this economy? I mean, if housing is sucking up all the money,
yeah,
you know, and we're out, you know, whether it's related, I don't know how related it is, you know, but we're seeing and hearing, you know, and I don't have figures to support this, but we see a lot of issues around how restaurants are struggling, for example, and some of that's just the challenge of coming off the pandemic. And higher prices and sometimes challenge getting workers. But, you know, I hear, you know, through discussions online, a lot of people just saying they just can't afford to go out anymore. You know, between the fact that prices are high at restaurants, higher than they ever were before, and they have less disposable income. So there we sort of see an area where perhaps we see that sector shrinking a bit. You know, perhaps there are going to be fewer restaurants and fewer people employed in that sector.
Yeah, there's so many, you know, wonderful restaurants that, you know, beloved restaurants, community institutions that have gone out of business because they can't afford rent. Because remember, there are some tenancy protections for residential renters, but there are no tenancy protections for commercial renters.
Mm-hmm.
And also the system is set up, as I know, it's in a system called triple net, where usually the tenant is responsible for land tax, responsible for utilities, responsible for management fees. And you can imagine if the tenant has to pay all these things in an appreciating real estate market, it's just a tremendous hardship for many small business owners.
And yeah, we definitely hear those stories too of where, you know, a business is shutting down because their rent is going up 50% or even 100%.
Or 300.
And all of a sudden it just no longer becomes, you know, practical to keep in business in that area.
And they have to raise prices as well because to keep themselves in business. And this is, you know, you made this point that, you know, every dollar spent on housing is a dollar coming out of something else. And it reminds me of a great point I learned back, you know, when I was, you know, like doing economics, which is that, you know, we talk about this thing called a multiplier in economics, where the government does Keynesian spending or whatever, and then every step of the way, you know, it multiplies. You know, the money you give to the carpenter spends on something else.
Yeah.
But this is working in reverse. Every dollar you have to take out of other things to spend on housing, that's less money to spend on the restaurants. And then the restaurant staff, out of what pay they receive, again, more of that money has to go into housing and less is left for anything else. So the multiplier actually decreases throughout the economy and this has a genuinely harmful effect.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, you know, I mean, there's a part of the housing, the whole sort of housing economy in which we have all the construction and development, which generates a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
Right? And that creates those spin-offs you're talking about. But once that's done and people are in ownership or in a rental situation, which is really important, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm correct in this, but, you know, and I'd love to talk to an economist or something who's got more expertise.
Yeah.
But it seems that money isn't spinning through the economy in the same way that money spent at a shop or a restaurant or in the community is in terms of spinning off and creating more jobs by circulating in the economy. It's kind of going to the rent and the people who, the, you know, the companies that own the rent, and then it just kind of goes there.
Absolutely. This is a great point because, and this is something, you know, we'd potentially be looking to get an economist on the show to talk about down the road. But, you know, like there's a, you know, housing is actually used by economists historically as the classic rent-based industry because it's literally called rent. Mm-hmm. But the concept of rent itself is also, it's similarly for economically inactive activity that doesn't generate other activities. It just sucks money out of the economy. And I think you're absolutely right that compared to, you know, like a restaurant or a fair or something where like there's active activity, once money, you know, goes into the rent, it's in someone's bank account, pays down the mortgage, and, you know, there you go, right?
Yeah. Like, all right, so those are things I think we'll see. We'll be doing some more exploring on the housing issues here on Speak Up in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah.
So look forward to that. Now we got some music for you. This is a band called Atlan Gunn, and this is a single from their album, and it's called Rakia Su Kayamam. I hope I got that pronounced right. Probably not. This is Atlan Gunn. Atlan Gunn. Beautiful. And their single, Rakira Su Katamam. They're a band, they're a Turkish band, and that single came out just earlier this year, and they have a whole album out to go with it, which is doing quite well, it seems, across Canada. Next up, we have Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Sometimes the cat meowing from the bushes isn't a cat at all, but a cat bird, the gray cat bird, to be exact. Named after their distinctive cat-like mew call. Gray catbirds are mimic thrushes, related to mockingbirds and thrashers. They can imitate a wide variety of noises, from songbirds to mammals to frogs. Males sing the loudest, but females sometimes respond with a quieter song of their own. Female and male gray catbirds both have a dark cap on their heads and a rusty brown patch under their long tails. They breed throughout much of the U.S. and spend winter in Central America and the Caribbean. Noisy and boisterous in the spring, a migrating flock of catbirds can fill a city park with sound. Catbirds are most at home in dense bushes and thickets. They love eating berries and other fruits, but they've also been seen snacking on cheese or a donut when they're available. Gray catbirds are improvisers in the foods they eat and in their ever-changing songs. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Notes provided by the Bobolink Foundation and generous listeners around the world.
This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Magnus.
And I'm Stephen.
And Stephen is going to be joining the program going forward. And we just talked a bit about some of the topics we're going to be covering here. But what made you want to get involved with the radio and doing this kind of radio work?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think one of the ways, you know, like it's the most important way is really that radio is community. Mm-hmm. Radio is kind of a technology that enables you to communicate and keep in touch with the community at large. And I think when you have a community as large and as diverse as the SFU community, the Burnaby Mountain community, radio is a really effective way to amplify voices that need to be heard, mm-hmm. to participate in a conversation, and to just be part of the general vibe of things, which I really do believe in. And that's kind of really the reason I want to get involved. You know, like I love public affairs. I love, you know, these interviews. I love, you know, these old school kind of radio shows, TV shows where, like, you really get to have these in-depth conversations with people. And I thought it would be wonderful if I had the opportunity to participate in one of these myself. And the opportunity came along, and I said yes.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing some of your interviews coming up in the next while.
Yep.
All right. We have a moving on here. We have an interview that's part of a series we did on traditional Chinese medicine. A number of years, for a long time, traditional Chinese medicine operated outside the sort of official stream of healthcare here in British Columbia. And I think it was about 15 years ago, but still relatively recently, the government sort of put in place a system to regulate and license traditional Chinese medicine and traditional Chinese medicine practitioners. But because of its you know, long years sort of in the shadows, so to speak, at least within the mainstream community, I think it was well understood within the Chinese community. A lot of people don't know a lot about it. And so Chris Spangenberg, a volunteer here at CJSF and programmer, did an 8-part series exploring many aspects of traditional Chinese medicine, and this is one of those interviews. In this interview, it's Chris Spangenberg interviewing Les Moncrief.
CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver, Burnaby Mountain. My name is Chris Spangenberg, and I am the producer of this current series of interviews you are about to hear. This is the seventh episode of an eight-part episodic series on traditional Chinese medicine, also known